From KUAZ, Arizona Public Media, I'm Mark McLemore, and this is Arizona Spotlight. Coming up on today's show, Claudine LaMonaco brings us a profile of the police chief of Mesa, Arizona, his controversial approach to dealing with illegal immigrants, his officers are instructed not to inquire about a person's citizenship when dealing with non-criminal cases. The city of Tucson has made a commitment to making sustainable solar energy a reality, and next week will play host to a conference of other Solar America cities. I'll talk to Bruce Plank, Tucson's solar energy coordinator, about what it all means. Tony Paniagua tells us the story of the amazing transformation of Caroline Fawcett, a recovered methamphetamine addict who's now doing outreach work to help others facing the same problem she was able to overcome. That's all coming up next on Arizona Spotlight. Cities around the country are grappling with the issue of whether police officers should investigate the immigration status of people they encounter while on duty. The Tucson police have said they don't want to enforce immigration laws, but they can and sometimes do call immigration in for cases as minor as a broken taillight. Human rights groups have protested that the policy is only driving immigrants further underground. A new police chief in Mesa, Arizona, just east of Phoenix, has stirred debate by taking a very different approach. From Mesa, Claudine LaMonaco has this report.
It's late Monday night, and Mesa police officer Nate Bolter is on patrol. He spots a dusty blue Hyundai Elantra with a license plate hanging from one side and pulls the car over.
How you doing tonight, sir?
Run in.
It's a typical stop for faulty equipment.
What's going on?
Yeah.
Speak English?
Sí.
Español?
Yeah.
Okay, ¿de dónde viene ahorita?
Bolter explains why he pulled the man over and asks the driver for his driver's license. The man, Nicandro Salado, said he doesn't have one, but he shows him a Mexican ID instead and proof of insurance. Back in the patrol car, Bolter runs a background check.
Since he has no warrants and nothing else, we'll just give him a ticket and kick him on his way.
Bolter hands the man a warning to fix the license plate and a ticket for driving without a license. But the stop is more remarkable for what Bolter doesn't do. It's clear the man is probably in the country illegally. He nearly confesses as much. But Bolter doesn't ask him about it and doesn't call Border Patrol. Bolter is carrying out a policy created by the Mesa City Council. Officers in Mesa have a strict policy not to call in Border Patrol when dealing with civil infractions, like traffic violations or faulty equipment. The idea is that police officers should focus on serious crime. The man in charge of enforcing the policy is Mesa Police Chief George Gascon. Gascon arrived in Mesa 20 months ago. He was recruited away from the Los Angeles Police Department, where he was second in command. A 28-year veteran police officer, who is also a lawyer, he has garnered criticism for the policy and his stance on immigration, in part because he has been so vocal about it.
One of the things that I first noticed when I came to Mesa was that there was a lot of misinformation going around that people that were here without documents were disproportionately committing crimes, predatory crimes. And one of the things I kept hearing is about 90% of our crime was being committed by undocumented immigrants.
Gascon looked into the statistics and found that Latinos in Mesa commit crimes in proportion to their population. They make up around 30% of the population here, and they commit around 30% of the crimes. Gascon says he speaks out because good policy and good policing are grounded in facts. He believes inaccurate statements on immigration are dangerous for everyone.
You're vilifying one segment of the community, and you're creating a level of racial animosity that translates itself in the development and the support for very bad public policy that actually hurts everyone equally.
Gascon says false claims that illegal immigrants cause most crimes channel resources away from cracking down on the real sources of serious crimes. And he's skeptical about polls showing Arizonans want police to crack down on illegal immigration.
I hear often people say, well, you know, the majority of the people voted for this or the majority of the people voted for that. And I always question, well, based on what level of information they had. You know, the majority of the Germans in 1933 voted for Hitler, and the majority of the Germans supported Hitler until Germany was destroyed. And then they look back and they say, my God, who do we support? So you can't always say that, you know, just because the majority in a particular time and place supported something that makes it right, especially when the majority is being fed so much information that is inaccurate by people that they believe and that they trust.
Gascon is a Cuban-American immigrant. He came to this country when he was 13 years old, after his family fled repression and communism in Cuba. He says the current anti-immigration climate reminds him of his childhood.
The fear was always, okay, is my dad going to come back home today from work? And I remember that being 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, and sometimes, you know, really wondering, is my father going to be back here tonight for dinner or not? Well, I'm seeing that level of fear in some of our communities here.
Gascon's critics say his police should go after illegal immigrants. State Representative Russell Pierce, who also hails from Mesa, is the most vocal critic of illegal immigration in the state legislature. Pierce did not return requests for an interview for this story, but he's currently trying to place a measure on the ballot in November that would require police officers across the state to check immigration status. Gascon's supporters say his approach has worked. Over the last 2 years, crime in Mesa has dropped 18%. Gascon says that wouldn't have been possible if he had to pull his officers away from serious crime to focus on immigration. One of the main reasons police departments don't want to get involved with immigration is because they say it will drive immigrants further underground, and police depend on them as witnesses to help report and solve crimes. Back out on the street, Officer Bolter is finishing up his stop with 50-year-old Nicandro Salado.
Adentro de este sobre contiene información en cuanto a esta infracción y la multa para ello.
As if on cue, Salado, a 12-year veteran with the Mexican military, spontaneously starts praising the Mesa Police Department. We support what you are doing, he tells him. We are not afraid to come to the police, and this way it makes it safer for everyone. Thank you for being so kind.
Bueno, okay, gracias.
Officer Bolter hands Salado the ticket and heads back to his car. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Claudine LaMonaco.
After being named as one of the first of America's solar cities, Tucson has been positioning itself on the forefront of solar energy use and development. With the abundant sunlight we have in the desert, it seems like a natural fit, and perhaps that's one reason why Tucson was selected to host a conference of America's solar cities starting next week. I asked Bruce Plank, the solar energy coordinator for Tucson, to tell us more. Thank you for joining me in the studio today, Bruce, to talk about this upcoming convention and more regarding Tucson's status as a solar city. So it was last year that Tucson was named one of the original solar cities. What does this mean?
Well, basically, Mark, the United States Department of Energy chose 13 cities around the country who had been doing something connected with solar to recognize them and name them Solar American Cities.
And this year, there are other cities joining the list?
Right. 12 new cities were just named at the end of March, and they're the 2008 crop of Solar America cities. So now we have 25 in total.
What kind of support for Tucson's status as a solar city do you see coming from state government?
Well, there hasn't been a lot of support from state government for solar, but there has been some. And that's played out in different ways. There's been some legislation at the state level that's been good and positive to help solar in Tucson. There are a number of proposals still pending in this year's legislature that may make solar easier for people to install. And there's been a strong commitment from the governor to support green building, solar, and things of that sort in general, in a lot of more general ways, not specifically for Tucson, but for the state of Arizona as a whole.
Do you anticipate that any new construction rules are going to go into effect that will make it easier for people to install solar energy in their homes?
Not on the state level, but at the city level in May, we anticipate that mayor and council will have before them a draft ordinance that would require all new residential construction of single-family homes and duplexes to be outfitted for later installation of solar hot water and solar electricity. And the idea would be to minimize or eliminate any costs that would be required to retrofit a building if someone wanted to do solar hot water at a later time.
What can you tell us about the solar convention that's coming to Tucson? What issues are going to be addressed and what are the goals?
Tucson was honored by being chosen as the host city for the first annual meeting of all of the Solar America cities solar energy coordinators. So we're going to have about 100 people that are involved in all aspects of the Solar America Cities program in all 25 of these cities. And the topics up for discussion include financing solar projects, removing barriers and burdens for potential solar projects, and that's all sorts of different city rules or potential problems that people might have with the city, talking about cities that have a history of installing solar and how they did it. And that's one of the places where Tucson fits on the list. And a variety of other more general issues, helping residents finance solar, how to find installers that can do the job, all those sorts of things. Because the whole point of this program is to get more solar on city rooftops in Tucson and elsewhere, and also educate the citizens in the Tucson area and in the other cities about solar, and remove whatever financial or other barriers there are to people putting up solar. Because as you know, solar is something that almost everybody says, hey, great idea, we ought to be doing it, particularly in sunny places. But if you look around, you don't see that much solar on people's roofs. And the whole point of this project is to figure out how to break through whatever limitations are in place or whatever barriers there are so that we can get more solar up on more rooftops.
What kind of changes are people going to be seeing in the city of Tucson because of its status as a solar city now?
Well, the first thing is people are going to start seeing signs around town on light posts that say, Tucson, Solar America City, because we just put those up. And we're in the midst of a little contest for people to locate and identify those. But people should keep their eyes out because those signs, by and large, are located near solar installations in town. So if you're driving around town and you see a sign that says Tucson, Solar America City, look around, and hopefully you're going to notice some solar panels somewhere nearby. So that's the very first thing we're doing, is to try to draw attention to solar installations that exist in the city. The second thing is we're going to be putting more solar systems on city buildings. And there are a couple of different proposals for that, and we've got some plans in the works. But we're hoping that by the end of this year, there'll be 7 large-scale solar systems put in place on city buildings and on city ground.
Recently, I've been hearing about Germany becoming a leading producer of solar energy, despite the fact that Arizona and some other southwestern states here actually get more sun. What can you tell me about that?
Well, it's possible under the laws in Germany to sign a contract that will pay you quite handsomely, something like 5 times what we're paying for electricity in Tucson, to produce electricity. So in Germany, you can put solar panels on your farm barn, on your garage roof, or whatever, and that solar energy that's generated will result in a revenue stream for you. So a lot of people are doing that because it means money's coming in. And Germany has high electric rates in the first place, much higher than we have, and they've created very high incentives for solar, and they've created a system where people can expect and even contract for payments for the solar energy they produce for up to 20 years. So essentially, people putting up solar in Germany have a guaranteed source of income at a fixed price that's high for many years.
Do you think that there's anything like that on the horizon for Arizona?
The issue about whether people in Arizona should be paid for the production of electricity and get incentives for that is something that is currently under discussion at the Arizona Corporation Commission, and it's likely that large-scale solar installations in Tucson in the TEP area, as well as in other parts of the state that are served by other utilities, will have a similar type system based on the amount of energy they produce. It won't be anything close to what Germany's paying, but it will be a reasonable amount of money, and that's one of the things that I think is likely to encourage more large-scale production. We're probably not going to see that on the homeowner-sized systems in the near future, but it's certainly a possibility.
Well, Bruce, thank you very much for your time. I appreciate you coming to the studio.
Sure. Thanks, Mark.
There's more Arizona Spotlight coming to you right after this break. Addiction to methamphetamine is one of the most urgent problems facing law enforcement around the country. The use of meth is on the rise among people in both urban and rural areas, but many concerned citizens have joined together to fight its spread. Next, Tony Paniagua brings us a profile of one woman who overcame her addiction to meth and who is now sharing her story with people struggling with the problem in their own lives.
Caroline Fawcett is in her 20s, but she tried methamphetamine as a teenager, and that experiment turned into a difficult and dangerous addiction.
It shocks me to think that I was the way that I was. I look back and think, how could I have settled for that?
When she reflects on the past few years, she finds them harsh and terrifying, a time when she risked her life and her future.
Skipping school. Skipping school, and somebody had it, and I didn't ask what it was or what was in it, and somebody just said it's good, and I tried it, and that was enough, you know? And I was hooked right away. Before I knew it, I was doing it all the time, and I didn't find out what was in it until after the fact, and by then I was pretty addicted to it.
Meth is made with cold tablets containing ephedrine or pseudoephedrine, but it's processed with products like alcohol, brake cleaner, drain cleaner, gasoline additives, and farm fertilizer. But despite its toxic composition, the addiction can be extreme.
It's like somebody's cup of coffee. Most people wake up and have a cup of coffee. I woke up and did that. That was my cup of coffee.
It's about the same amount of money to purchase compared to cocaine, but it lasts longer.
James Cunningham worked at the Center for Applied Behavioral Health Policy at the University of Arizona in 2006 when he completed an extensive report about meth in our state, and the statistics are staggering. Meth use is rising sharply, and the number of hospital admissions is basically the same for men and women.
He actually did some long-term trends. We looked at 15 years of hospital admissions in Arizona. And we found that in the last 5 years, from 2000 to 2004, methamphetamine admissions increased threefold in the state and increased fourfold in Pima County.
While authorities around the country are targeting meth labs in people's homes or businesses, Arizona poses another problem. Most of the meth is being made south of the border.
And one of the things about Arizona is that we're close to the source. So if you look at the purity levels, which we have, Arizona has some of the highest purity levels in the whole country. And so on average, the higher the purity, the more the health problems, the faster the addiction and so on.
And even if you feel safe because no one seems to be doing meth in your neighborhood, all of us still pay the price. Experts estimate the state is spending millions of dollars on meth every year because of border issues, public health, welfare, environmental cleanup, and crime.
One wrong move, you can blow up the entire front of your house.
Sergeant Terry Statton works for the Pima County Sheriff's Department. He says users are breaking into houses, stealing cars, burglarizing stores, and even going through mailboxes for checks and credit card information. They are part of another expensive epidemic, identity theft.
They'll take the identity of another to write checks or get bank account numbers or do other things in order to generate money to buy methamphetamines. It's amazing the connections that we have with the crimes that are going on in Pima County that are related to meth.
Many of the users have children, and those kids become innocent victims. It can be physical or emotional abuse, or even death.
A story out of New Mexico a couple years ago where a father actually killed his own child, cut his head off, because he thought his child was talking to other people about the drug use that he was going through. It's sad that those things happen. The paranoia, again, is extremely high with these people.
Back at the park where we spoke to her, Caroline Fawcett tells us she began to use meth at 17, but quit when she became pregnant with her daughter. However, Fawcett resumed her use after the baby was born, and soon she lost everything. Her house, her car, her job, and finally her daughter. That was the last straw for Fawcett. She checked into rehab.
Child Protective Services took my child for allegations of drug use. So once they took her from me, I was willing to do anything. I was pretty much at their mercy and was willing to do anything. I knew that I had to have something. I knew before that I needed to do something about it.
Fawcett has been clean since September 11 of 2003, and she's regained custody of her daughter, the most important person in her life. But even though things are much better now, she's using her past experiences to try to help others. She's been writing letters and speaking to government officials and other agencies, hoping for more compassion and understanding when it comes to meth addicts. And she says additional treatment facilities are vital.
They need to want to get clean. It's got to be a desire for them. They have to want it. You can't put somebody in treatment that doesn't want it. But there are so many people out there that do want it, but there's just no availability. it just breaks my heart to see people out there. So I've made it a point to keep my success of recovery as an open book, because I wanted people to see that it's possible and that you're not a lost hope and there is hope.
And Fawcett is proving that personally. A life that could have ended in tragedy has been turned into an example.
Well, I have a great job. I work for a great company. I have a wonderful life. I'm a good mom. I go to school. I have a 4.0 GPA at school. My life has changed. I'm doing things in my life that I knew I was strong enough for, but I just couldn't get past it. Because the drugs were more important to me.
Still, experts fear for the future of other people in Arizona and around the country. Meth continues to be extremely popular in many states, and many more teens and adults are willing to take a chance with their lives. For Arizona Spotlight, I'm Tony Paniagua.
Arizona Public Media joins with other television broadcast partners on Tuesday, April 15th at 6:30 in the evening to air Crystal Darkness, a half-hour documentary exploring the dangers of crystal meth. In addition, Arizona Public Media will air a special segment devoted to this topic on the Monday, April 14th edition of the news magazine, Arizona Illustrated. For more information about the documentary and the campaign to stop the use of methamphetamine, you can visit crystaldarkness.com. We have the link online at KUAZ.org. Based on a recent study, there is less juvenile crime being committed in our area. Bill Buckmaster discusses the current state of juvenile crime in Pima County with juvenile court presiding judge Patricia Escher.
Judge Escher, thanks for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here.
What is your take on this study?
Well, it's a very thorough study of a number of studies that have been done across the country. And my hope is that it will prompt some discussion, as the report itself suggests, it will prompt some discussion about whether the results that were hoped for as a result of the adoption of the transfer laws are results that we're actually seeing. When those laws were adopted, the hope was that by transferring more youth for prosecution and punishment as adults, we would see a deterrent effect and lower crime rates. That doesn't seem to have happened. So it's probably a good time to take a look at what are the costs and benefits of these laws.
And we should say that the number, the percentage of youngsters who are transferred into the adult court is very small, the percentage.
It is very small. Last year in Pima County, 93 youth were tried as adults.
And that is down, though, considerably from the mid-90s.
That's true. Before the law was in effect, about 100 youth had been transferred by judicial order. And these are, you would expect this to happen. There are some youth who commit crimes that are so serious that they should be tried as adults, and some youth who commit crimes and they're so close to their 18th birthday that we really can't achieve any sort of rehabilitation in the short time that's left to us. So that number was around 100 in 1996. It went up as high as 224 after the law was passed in 1998, and then it has gradually gone down, as I indicated, to 94 last year.
And of course, the law was passed in the mid to late 90s because of a fear of increasing juvenile crime. This is something that really hasn't played out, correct?
No, for reasons I don't think everyone really understands, although a lot of theories are proposed. The crime rate has actually decreased significantly, even though our juvenile population has increased by 10% over the last 5-6 years. The rate of crime, and specifically the rate of violent crime, has actually decreased quite significantly.
Judge, what's your profile of a typical juvenile offender who appears before your court?
Well, virtually all youth who come into the court experience one or more of the following things. They very commonly are substance abusers. Their families are experiencing the stressors of poverty. They may have a single parent who's working two jobs trying to make ends meet. These youth often have a mental health diagnosis. They commonly have learning disabilities, or if not that, they're not attending school or they're failing in school. It's not uncommon to have one parent who is incarcerated. These children have witnessed or been victims of domestic violence. A lot of risk factors for these kids. So what we see are youth who aren't committing, on the whole, terribly serious crimes, but they have tremendous needs that hopefully will be met not just through the juvenile justice system, but by other stakeholders, the education community, child protective services, behavioral health.
Are there some cost benefits to keeping the offenders in the juvenile system as opposed to adult system?
Well, I believe in the juvenile system, we have services available to us that are not necessarily available in the adult system. For example, in a case where a youth has committed more serious crimes and has not shown that they're willing or able to comply with conditions of probation, we have access to residential programs where youth are placed in a structured situation with education, they learn life skills, they participate in sports, that help them to amend their lives and learn how to be law-abiding citizens who can take care of themselves before they become adults. If they don't learn this before they become adults, then they're much more likely to commit crimes and become enmeshed in a criminal lifestyle with the larger social costs that that entails. Not just the cost of incarceration and prosecution, but you have people who aren't educated, who aren't in the workforce, who aren't paying taxes, who aren't contributing to society.
Would you like the lawmakers to take a second look, perhaps, at these harsh punishments for juveniles?
I think any time you undertake a change in what you're doing, it's always a good idea to evaluate whether you're achieving what you intended to achieve. I think this study and the earlier study that was produced by the Children's Action Alliance in 2003, you know, would suggest that maybe we need to take a second look at this and see if it's accomplishing what we want to.
One success story is the drug courts. There's two of them now?
We have two in the adult system, and we have two in the juvenile system. The ones in the juvenile system, there's a juvenile drug court for adolescents, and there's a family drug court for parents of children who are in foster care to help them overcome their drug addictions and reunite with their children. And the latter, the family drug court, has been very successful with the people who graduate from drug court. 96% of them are successfully reunited with their children. That's a very high rate.
And are you starting to see some results with the juvenile drug court?
We are. I don't have data for you today, but it's a very intensive program, and the graduates, these youth come from enormously difficult circumstances, and they go on to enormous success. They graduate from high school, they get jobs, they go on to college. They're very productive kids.
Okay. Bottom line, whatever the reasons are, we can say that juvenile crime is down here in Pima County.
It definitely is.
Judge, thanks for being with us.
It was my pleasure.
That's Arizona Spotlight for this week. Thank you for listening. Arizona Spotlight is a production of KUAZ Radio, Arizona Public Media, and is produced in the KUAZ studios by Jim Blackwood, with production assistance from Ginger Duran and Stephanie Varney. Our executive producer is Peter Michaels. Most of the music heard on our program, including the theme, was written and performed by Calexico. Audio archives of our past shows, as well as podcasts of Arizona Spotlight, are available online at KUAZ.org. I'm Mark McLemore.